Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Susan McDuffie and Marie Romero Cash about their new mysteries. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Yvonne Awor. She is an award-winning author from Kenya. She's visiting Santa Fe right now. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So we're going to hear a little bit of reading of your work in a moment, but I wanted to start by asking you, what is the literary scene like in Kenya?
It is remarkably thriving the trend that started in the year 2002 has continued.
What happened in 2002?
There's this explosion. All sorts of people came out of different closets, and a new kind of writing emerged that is very different from the writing that had gone on before in Kenya. What has been called the post-independence generation of Kenyans, who are writing about Kenyan experiences rather than looking at somebody else to blame for our particular experiences. Yes.
Very interesting. So basically a generation came of age that was not just dealing with politics and colonialism.
Exactly. Dealing with politics, but not necessarily dealing with colonialism. And I think the coincidence of 2002 was a kind of transition. That was when the Moi regime, lost its particular power, and a new kind of regime came into place. Well, that's what we thought at the time.
And so when you say people came out of the closet, what kinds of authors emerged? I mean, what kind of new themes and voices came out?
Incredible stuff around, spoken word. A version of rap again, but also very, very urban, very local. All sorts of poetry. And new literature, and creative nonfiction, actual nonfiction and fiction. I was in the fiction category.
You've always been a fiction writer.
Yes, fiction.
Now, Kenya has a long centuries or perhaps millennia-old oral tradition and a more recent written tradition. Mm-hmm. How do they come together?
In multiple ways. The essence of story does not change. The medium may be adapted, but the whole idea of story and the whole idea of narrative structure and the whole idea of voice, all those things that are essential to any narrative form, come together beautifully both in oral literature and in...
The oral literary tradition that you have, in what ways is it passed down? Did you grow up hearing the true Kenyan stories?
I was lucky in that my Uncle Okoyo, and my grandmother, both grandmothers when they were both alive, would probably, just to make me stop annoying them, would tell me endless stories about the hyena or the hare, and incredible stories that peopled my own life. And then, of course, the radio station. At that time, there was only one radio station in Kenya, VOK, would have some, I forget her name, Auntie So-and-so, who'd tell stories from all over the republic.
Interesting. Did a lot of them, you talk about the hyena, did a lot of them have animal themes, animal characters?
Oh, yeah. So, yes, I grew up with a lot of animal characters.
Did you grow up in the city?
I grew up in the city, yes. But again, the idea of Kenya, not quite schizophrenic, but we have two different lives. Many of us have the city life and then the rural home or the country home. So we navigate between those particular worlds.
Was that true for you too?
Yeah, very true for me.
What was your country home life like?
I think for a child, magical, in that... We weren't there long enough to not appreciate not having electricity. So at that time, there was no electricity or running water. So you'd go to the river. At night, the magic of fireflies and lit hearths and lanterns, and murmured voices. So I hold on to the magic of that time. Mm.
What are your native languages?
I speak Luo. That's my traditional language, both my parents. And then in Kenya, of course, Kiswahili is one of our national languages.
Yeah. And so you grew up speaking Luo, Swahili, and English.
Yes.
And to what extent do non-English languages make their way into Kenyan literature, which by and large is written in English, is that correct?
It is, but they're written in Kenyan English. English that is influenced by the Kenyan environment, by the Kenyan experiences, and some of the expressions and words that are specific to Kenya have crept into the English that we write.
What are some examples of that?
Some that you know, things like safari.
Right.
The other things would be, you can find it, I guess you can find it in some of the writing that authors from Kenya put together.
Shall we read some of your writing right now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, this is from a book called Dust and Memory.
Yes.
Give us some background on this novel.
Well, it's a novel that, when I'm being unkind, I say it's become a relationship. It's been very much a teacher to me.
What do you mean?
I have suffered a little bit through it. Oh, no, I've suffered a lot through it in terms of learning how to write. It may sound very strange, but literally learning how to let characters speak for themselves rather than my imposing structure and dialogue and vocabulary. It's been a long journey with this.
Is it finished or you were still working on it?
I imagine it is finished, but I keep getting tempted to go back to it.
So you haven't published it yet?
No, I haven't published it yet. It should be published, though, sometime this year.
So here is just a piece of the novel, Dust and Memory. We're talking to Yvonne Orr.
Okay. I'm reading from the second chapter, where a sister has found out her brother has died. Death slow marches at 3:30. On the branch of a deformed grevillea, a metallic mauve bird tweets. Inside the morgue, the chill makes hands pale yellow, the same as Odidi's long, thick fingers. He's been dressed up by his father and sister. Olive khaki suit, black socks and tan leather shoes, purchases from a half-closed, guarded nearby mall. There are rumors of chaos out there. But in this other place, documents signed, all protocol observed, Moses Odidi Oganda is officially dead. Outside, there are gray skies, darting shadows, a pair of battler eagles, prophet birds like marabou storks. They know when a body is cooling. Savannah birds circling a city tottering on the edge of a chasm. Four men advance in step towards a white hearse. Red tattered ribbons flutter from the windows. Arabel Oganda shivers, breathing into her hand. She hunts and pecks at words, emerges empty. Inside her body, she feels blistered and bruised in hidden places. Her eyes on her father's shiny, always black shoes, shoes that underline his out-of-placeness. Nyipir Oganda, her father, is tall and slender and dark, an old-world dapper in his 1970s coat and 1950s brown leather fedora with manners to match. As with so many men of Kenya from his time, his manner is genteel, colonial, almost Churchillian English, complete with bored, stiff upper lip. Baba, an arrangement of letters. What she wants to say is, look, the birds. Anything other than that to talk about. A beige wood coffin contains all that remains of his son. The thought possesses Nyipir's eyes and voice. He breathes out a lullaby. Ajahn moves 1 foot towards him. She stops. Her head is tilted, listening for directions in a now-changed world. Baba. Her mouth forms a word, but there is no sound. Nyipir, Ali, Dr. Mda, and a snaggle-toothed mortuary attendant lift Odidi's coffin up and slide it into the hearse. harmony in step. Bruised faces belie their outward peace. There had been a tussle inside the morgue next to the silver autopsy bay when Nyipir had said, "I'll take my son home now." Dr. Mda, the pathologist, had retorted, "This is a police case. The cadaver belongs to the state." His tone had led Nyipir to grab Dr. Mda's neck and squeeze as a python might. Ali Didahada, the police supervisor, had sauntered over and watched a bit. And then he said, "Me, I say, there's no case." Dr. Mda's eyes popped. He made a bleating sound. "You brought me here." "Yes," said Ali Didahada, "to show how this cannot be a police case." Outnumbered and practical, Dr. Mda found a proper cause of death for Odidi. Exsanguinations caused by pneumothorax and heart failure. Odidi was going home after all. Distant sirens, a thump in the hearse's boot. Ajahn's body jerks. Odidi's coffin is pale behind the rear window. The driver, Leonard, thin-faced bones casting defined shadows, waits. He has wrapped a white handkerchief around his coat's upper arm and assumed a funereal look. He had earlier brought Ajahn and Nyipir in from the airport in a green saloon taxi. It is gone. A fireball works its way out of Ajahn's throat and it becomes a nose tickle and scatters as tears. She scrubs her face dry with trembling hands. Before now was a green car. 5 hours and 43 minutes ago. Before now was rained upon earth, mingling with smoke and age and dust and sun and cows on a father's coat and her head tucked into its folds in welcome. The scent of coming home from far away. But now, now is an icy season thick with dread. It's a youthful quartet, oozing ragged old clothes smell. Their wet eyes a counterpoint to life-hardened faces. It is an adorned, rough-edged, empty coffin on the ground nearby, next to a shaggy-haired woman in red. Wife, mother, sister? Grief-stripped, soul-bared, panel-beaten features. Under the weak sun, her look speaks of a hemorrhaging. Ajahn Oganda averts her eyes. There are no manuals showing safe maps through human messiness. Where is her brother? Where is Odidi? Sorrow gallops in, seizes and inserts itself into her body from the left side. It hooks claws into her heart. She rakes her right arm with broken nail fingers, grunts at the naked, gauzy outline of cold shadows in an afternoon made of fear. Shuffling footsteps, no flowers, no cottage. A brother leaving a Saar morgue where other corpses wait for their living to take them away. Ajahn and her father approach the hearse, slip in, and take their seats. A new pulsating ghost between them. Like all the others, it is molded out of hard, deep, and buried silences.
Yvonne Awar reading from her novel, Dust and Memory. I was going to ask you about both this and some of the other work that you've done. Is this based on any kernel of a true story?
Yeah, it certainly is inspired by Kenyan events and the idea of what I call the buried ghosts, the silences that even as a nation, we have collectively chosen not to look at the horrible violence perhaps we have visited upon one another, either as a communities or as members of the state. We are very good at burying our ghosts.
And so, as a writer, you bring those ghosts forward, basically.
I do. And particularly in the context of our 2007, how shall one put it, disintegration.
What happened in 2007?
We had the election was disputed, and the country went, just rose up. A lot of, just people rose up in complete protest. And for the first time, we came very close to civil war, but just pulled back from the brink. But what startled me most was were comments from the older generation of people. Who kept saying, I'm thinking of people like some of my parents and some of their own friends who in 2007 was saying this is for 1969. And after that, I started to ask what was 1969 about and how come even in school we did not hear too much about 1969. That was the time when the former Minister of Economic Affairs, Mr. Tom Blair, was assassinated.
Now, was there in 2007 a generational split politically?
There was a generational split. And a lot of us suspect that there was a major generational shift. That the older generation, the ones who had entrenched themselves and actually, in a way, I hold them responsible for the chaos that ensued, were not able to confront or just deal with. I suspect that a younger generation had voted for another set of people. But there's a generation that have been entrenched since the colonial days, who cannot imagine that Kenya can exist without them.
Now, when you write a novel, a short story, when you're many peers in this Kenyan literary explosion that's happening now in Nairobi and I guess in other cities as well, how do you get your work out? Are people buying books? Are they reading your work on the internet? Are they listening to you? What's going on?
Well, I was actually first published on the internet. And and the work was widely available on the internet. So I met quite a few people who have first encountered my work through the internet. People are buying my work and other people's work in the city. And that's very, it's very refreshing and very affirming to find our own people consuming the literature that they feel resonate with their own imaginings and questions. And more interestingly is that a lot of us found that we had global agents looking for us. So I'm represented by an Englishman.
And so you're being read in England?
I'm read in England and in the Commonwealth.
And in Australia?
The Commonwealth countries, yes.
Where
I just went, yes. Yes.
Describe that a little bit. You went to Brisbane, Australia.
Yes.
How were you received?
Oh, with such charming warmth and curiosity, certainly, and a great affection. And I will reemphasize the curiosity. I've never been in a space where the love for literature or love for the word. Is so very apparent and very overt. So,
and they were arguing with you about your own work.
Yes, it was at that moment that, despite all the all the struggle with the word, with being true to character, that's the moment you kind of think, so this is why, this is what it's all about.
This is why you write.
This is why I write. Yes,
we're talking to Yvonne Awar. So there is another story that you read, and I don't know that we'll have time to read much of it or any of it right now, but it was about a Rwandan refugee, very well-educated, in Kenya, and it's absolutely harrowing. I was almost hard to read. It was heart-wrenching to read about this man who was so unwelcome and had so much trouble basically finding a place to be safe.
Yeah. Okay.
That's another story that sounds like it was based on some grain of truth.
The Weight of Whispers. Actually, the story that launched my literary life.
Yeah.
Yes. I think the grain of truth, the feeling of exile, or what an old colleague of mine used to call inzile. You can be at home and not feel at home.
Right, inzile, exile.
Yes. The whole idea of alienation but also self-alienation, the things that, you can be so entrenched in your own way that you are not able to open your eyes to the other possibilities.
Yeah. I was thinking as I read that story that here you are, a Kenyan woman writing about how cruel Kenyans are to somebody from the outside.
I think we are one country that have been for a very long time the played host to probably the greatest numbers of refugees anywhere, and refugees from all over the world. I wonder if it was mostly, questioning the idea of the extent and limit of hospitality.
Right.
Yes, we do regard ourselves as a very hospitable people, a hospitable nation, and in so, so many ways we are. But I think there comes a moment when we lose awareness of the time when we feel this is too much. We've reached the limit.
It's a question of numbers.
A question of numbers, but also a question perhaps is it fatigue? Or a certain exhaustion? And a certain moment, a certain hubris as well, when you stop looking at the humanity of another human being, of someone else, and you start regarding them as a burden.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
There is, in your work, I guess some recurring themes about corruption, injustice, there's theft, there's rage, there's shame, all of these things that certainly are with all of us in mm-hmm. some way. But in your work, and I've only read a few of your stories and that part of the novel that you were just reading from, Dust in Memory, but I guess I was thinking that in American literature and an American experience, those things are there too. Mm. But somehow, is it more on the surface where you live in your experience?
Well, I think a lot of my own questions, which informs the detangling that writing does for me, comes not just the questions are around my eternal puzzlement at what human beings can do to other human beings. And it's not necessarily restricted to Kenya. Kenya is the stage through which I express those questions. Perhaps prematurely, I guess, because it's from childhood when I first encountered the narratives of Auschwitz. I shouldn't have, but I did. And I remember the sense of horror, complete, as horrified as a child can be, and the sense of being haunted, frankly, and the fear that the world, my magic world, was not as magical as I had imagined that it was. And so I guess those questions and those literary and image experiences have pursued me. And when I see the same moments of human horror appearing and emerging in my country, my beautiful country, I rage. And if I cannot rage as Yvonne, my characters rage.
Right.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Now, when you say, if I cannot rage as Yvonne, can you not rage as Yvonne?
As perhaps Yvonne the writer can. I'm not sure. I will probably tend to either float through life or immerse myself in life experiences. And it's almost like two personalities, the Yvonne the corporate worker or the event producer. Yvonne the, you know, the, almost the social butterfly who dips into the life experiences. And then Yvonne, the writer, who reflects on, mulls over, contemplates, and lists the questions, explores the meaning, and finds the character through whom to speak.
We're talking to Yvonne Awor, author from Kenya, who's visiting Santa Fe. Now, you're here in the United States, and you are, at the moment, what you called before we went on the air, gainfully unemployed and actually devoting time to writing. Is that right?
Yes.
What's that like?
Delightful. I always feel as if I'm encountering pieces of the old Yvonne. I had been caught up in the corporate space, as much fun as it was. I think there's this other creature that has been longing to breathe, and I am breathing.
There's such a sense in your work of sensory detail, I think. Mm-hmm. There's almost not a sentence that goes by where you don't see and feel sensations of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, I guess.
I mean, is that... I guess it just seems to be a sensibility that you bring to your writing. Do you write poetry as well?
Well, closet poetry, like I told somebody. But I guess that's how I feel the world. It's not just through my eyes. It's not just the world I see, but I need to hear it. And you know, I imbibe the world. You know, being here in Santa Fe, feeling Santa Fe inside of me, that's how I walk through life.
Now, I have to ask you this because you're here. What is your sense at this point right now about how Kenyans feel about Obama?
You know, no matter what he does, we will always regard him as a son of our land, you know, because of his father. And he has great defenders in the petition. It's that whole thing of, you know, whatever any member of your family does, no matter what he does, he's family.
So not a lot of criticism?
No, you won't find that. You'll find a lot of defending of Obama and a lot of loathing of those who loathe him.
Ah, very interesting.
Yes.
Who you mean people from abroad?
Whoever doesn't like Obama. I think you Tea Partiers. For example?
Yes, for example. So what are you working on now?
Well, actually here to finish a travel piece, assignment I'd been given last year, which involved visiting Congo, the DRC, Kinshasa specifically, at the time of the World Cup.
Uh-huh.
And experiencing Kinshasa through the environment of the whole, you know, the whole World Cup, and I'd never been there before, and so there's a deadline which I need to meet.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
For what publication?
It was a work commissioned by the Chinua Achebe Center at Bard College, headed by Binyavanga Wainaina, and they had sent 13 writers from Africa to African cities and Salvador de Bahia to go. We all went to cities we had never been to before. And 2 weeks, intense journeys across these cities.
Yeah. What was it like?
For me?
Yeah.
In Kinshasa?
Yeah.
In every single way, mind and soul blowing. In every single way. In very unexpected ways. It's a very visceral space, raw in every single sense. The art is very immediate, very powerful, very potent. It's an incredible, just such an incredible experience. And the whole idea of looking beyond the surface of things is very, very, very prevalent there. The first glance is one of those places where they say the first glance is never, never, never what the essence of whatever is happening is.
I mean, when I think of the Democratic Republic of Congo, I think of Eve Ensler and her work there exposing the incredible brutality and rape used as a weapon and these women who are completely or almost destroyed and then coming back into their power. Did you witness or see any of that legacy?
Well, you know, you cannot help but run into, you encounter perhaps individuals or those who are dealing with some of the atrocities that are taking place in the east of Congo, and there are several. This is not just one of them. And not to minimize the horrific nature of this abuse, but I think one of the things that does strike you about the Congo is that the whole country is raped. You have all sorts of awful global mercenaries, the worst kind of human beings lurking there. You hear all sorts of stories of those who have taken whole tracts of land, including corporate, respectable corporates that are perhaps even linked to the U.S., who have allocated to themselves entire spaces where the global, you know, coal train and all the sorts of minerals needed for technology and other things are. And so I think what worries me a lot is that some of the more, if you want, brutal narratives that implicate a whole lot of people are not and will not be heard as people get entirely preoccupied with Eve Ensler and her work with the women of Congo. And again, I'm not minimizing that, and I'm also very aware of a whole lot of other women who have been doing incredible work with the women of Congo around in spaces, in places where rape has been used as a weapon of war. Perhaps this is also a time to give complete tribute and honor to the women of Congo, the incredible women who have been able in so many ways to do more than a lot to ensure that that situation is alleviated. Yeah.
Yvonne Awor is an award-winning Kenyan writer, and unfortunately her reading is passed, so we can't send people to that. But I wanted to ask you one more thing. And again, this is a naive question. I've never been to Africa. I don't know that much about contemporary African politics. But is there a sense of kind of pan-African unity? Do you feel yourselves, people from different countries? Here you are from Kenya, you go to the Congo, you go to other countries. Do you come together politically, spiritually?
That's a fascinating question, because growing up we kept hearing a lot about pan-Africanism. And I think one of the things that strikes you the moment you travel within the continent is how vast it is, how diverse, how very different it is. And so in certain places, my first encounter with West Africa, I made the assumption that just because I was a black woman, I would be able to find resonance and sisterhood, immediate sisterhood, among my other black African sisters. And that was not the case. And that has not been the case. So, again, one is struck completely by the vastness and the depth of the African continent. It's a massive place, and I've certainly lost the temptation to make assumptions of assumed commonality. But then, yes, there are places of connection, and there are spaces of, I think, psychological sharing and values, the sense of hospitality that is unmistakable and uniquely and distinctly African, the sense of community and family that is very recognizable. So once you've negotiated the space, your space as a stranger, you find welcome in a way, in a very visceral and heartfelt way, in a way that I don't think I've ever felt anywhere else.
Where did you go in West Africa?
I was in Ghana. I passed through Burkina Faso as well, yeah.
And you were not embraced and treated as a sister from Kenya?
I was treated as any stranger should be treated. You kind of establish who are you, what do you want? Yeah, that kind of thing.
Now, do you, in terms of the literary world, do you share across Africa? You know, you have this burgeoning literary scene in Kenya, as you describe it. Do you share that with other African countries and their literary scenes?
Oh, yes. What happened when Kenya erupted, and I will certainly mention my friend and writer Binyavanga Wainaina at this stage, one of the first things he quickly did was connected with the different parts of the continent, West, North, South, Africa. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly enough, there were pockets of individuals and communities that were emerging with incredible literary forms and materials. And there was then, there have been a few convergence points, certainly in Nairobi. There's a Kwani Lit Fest that brings together writers who are in Africa once a year. And at that point, meeting as writers, meeting as artists, meeting as African artists, There is a complete sense of camaraderie and belonging. That's very, very, very unique, very special.
I was thinking there, I don't know if there's exactly an analogy, but I was thinking of Latin America, and people from the U.S. kind of think of, if uneducated at least, people will think of it as one place. Whereas if you look at the historical and musical and artistic traditions and political traditions of Latin America and where people emigrated from, they're as vast and as different as any countries can be. And
exactly.
Whether or not there is pan-Latin American unity, I mean, in some ways there are some political trends and so on, but there is just as different as human beings can be.
They are, and that's a reality. I mean, take a country like Brazil. That country alone and the diversity, just, you know, from one space to another, that place alone is incredible.
Right.
Yeah.
Yvonne Uwar is an award-winning writer from Kenya. Now, do you have a website, or is there a place where people can go and find out more about your work?
Well, you can go get... I don't have a website. I still need to overcome that concern. But you can get some information from kwani.org.
And that's spelled...
kwani.org.
Thank you so much for being with us, Yvonne, on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Marie Romero Cash and Susan McDuffie. Marie is the author of a new mystery called Shadows Among the Ruins, and Susan is author of another new mystery called The Fairy Hills. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
And so the two of you have been paired by the wonderful Dorothy Massey at Collected Works Bookstore and will both be speaking this Friday, the 13th of May, at 6 in the evening. And it's so interesting because there are two completely different kinds of books. One is set in Santa Fe, completely in the here and now, the book Shadows Among the Ruins. And for those of us who live here or anywhere near here, you can see it, smell it, taste it. It's people and characters whom we know. And then The Fairy Hills is set in 14th century Scotland. Very different challenges writing these two kinds of books. Should we start with Scotland?
Sure.
So how do you do the research, and how do you get kind of the feeling of this time and place?
Well, I love doing the research parts of it. It's always been... You know, I was one of those people that maybe always thought she had been born in the wrong century and had this desire to kind of escape to the past. About 10 or 15 years ago, I thought, oh my God, they didn't have Clorox. And that kind of has done a lot to reconcile me to modern life. But the past always...
Yeah, or Novocaine.
Novocaine, you know... sanitary doctors, you know, there were lots of advantages to living now. And so I've kind of become reconciled, but the past was always a big, big draw. And the Scottish end of it, I have some family connections. And actually the sleuth in this book and my first book, it's the same sleuth. It's kind of loosely based on some stories about the McDuffie clan, and the McDuffies supposedly were the keepers of the records for the Lords of the Isles, which even as a child I just thought sounded so mysterious, and it was probably actually fairly boring. It was probably recording a lot of treaties and land dispositions and things like that, but it sounded really wonderful. So the first book was kind of explaining how that came about. And then the second, one of the things I love about historical fiction is trying to put yourself back into the state of someone in that time, you know, how they thought. And one of the seeds for this book was a story I came across, which actually was not that long ago. It was in the 1890s, a case in Ireland called the Bridget Cleary case. And a man became convinced his wife was a fairy changeling, and he murdered her in an attempt to drive the fairy out of his wife. He burned her to death. And so I was kind of thinking, well, my God, if that was going on in 1892, what was happening in 1373, you know, what would it be like to live in a culture that believed so strongly in the good people, is what they call
fairies.
In fairies.
I mean, is it recorded that people truly, really believed in fairies?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It's like those myths. I mean, you know, nominally at that point, all of these areas were Christian, but there was still a lot of the old beliefs that kind of were prevalent.
And so then it puts you in the position of writing a kind of magic realism that maybe for them was more like real realism.
Yeah, it's not a paranormal book at all.
No.
But just that sense of, you know, I mean, all of our worldviews are so shaped by what we believe, you know. I mean, now we believe in science or, you know, whatever, you know, a lot of us do. But, you know, what would it really be like to believe that these people could spirit you away or that, I mean, if somebody... Well, this case in Ireland, she came back. She used to go hang out at these fairy forts, these ring forts, where everybody told her she shouldn't go. And she came back, and they just said, she's not herself. You know, there was a couple of theories about that, but she seems shorter. She's just not herself. The fairies have taken her.
Right.
You know, to really believe that, what would that do?
Right. Now, Marie Romero-Cash, you have written a book, and it's your first mystery, which is set in Santa Fe and starts, as any good mystery does, with a murder.
Absolutely, but writing a mystery came about as a fluke. I was attending the New Mexico Book Awards last year because my memoir was up for an award, and Ann Hillerman was there, and Tony Hillerman had recently passed, and she gave a talk about that year's Tony Hillerman Award was increased to $10,000, and I thought, wow, that would be cool, but I don't know anything about writing a mystery. And my son, Gregory, encouraged me and said, Mom, you're a good writer. You can write a mystery. So I set about learning how to write a mystery.
How did you do that?
I absolutely read about 58 mysteries in 2 months, every night, every day, every spare moment I had. During that period of time after Christmas, I take a couple of months off to do something else besides art. So I read a lot and then developed the story slowly. And it became book. It was just really an interesting process. I'm a great admirer of people who can do research, and figure out how to put something historical. But this was writing what you know.
Yeah.
I was familiar with the Cerrillos area. It was based really on the Cash Ranch, which is still out there, and the Indian Ruins, which is still out there, and Forrest Fenn owns the Indian Ruins. I introduced him to the ruins some years ago, and he bought them, and I always had a fondness for the whole area. So it was writing about things I knew and developing the mystery of trying to make a page turner. That was another process of how you write and how do you keep your reader interested in it. And I worked
cliffhangers at the end of every chapter.
Exactly. And I worked with an editor who stressed that. He says you cannot let this chapter go without saying something that's going to make them want to wonder, uh-oh, what's happening next?
And then what you do is you go to a different scene, and the reader's mind is still at the cliffhanger, and I found myself kind of paging forward to see if I could find out what happened.
Well, and that all also was a learning process, because I had to learn how to keep the story going, but also focus on what else was going on during that time, not just following this random murderer around. And it was fun because I wanted everybody to think one person was the killer, and yet I had a totally different person in mind. And so that's how it was, a real learning process for me. Unfortunately, that year they didn't give a Tony Hillerman Award. They had 100 entries, and they felt that out of the 100, none of them met their criteria.
Oh.
So that was what happened with the Tony Hillerman Award that year.
But you learned how to write a mystery. Are you going to continue?
oh, listen, I have two sequels done.
With the same heroine?
With the same heroine.
Jemima Hodge.
Jemima Hodge. And the interesting thing about it is that I so wanted in the first one to get them together, to get her and the detective together. And the editor kept saying, no, just hold off. Abstinence. He says you can get them together some other time. So in the sequel, they do get together.
Ah, well, you've just given that away. But that's all right, because it's definitely worth reading. And I have to say, the same thing happens when one reads the work of Michael McGarrity, which is also set around here. And it's so familiar and friendly. So many, and I wanted to ask you both this, so many authors whom I've had on the air have talked about this experience of having, at a certain point, the characters dictate what they want to do, whether or not it's what you want to do. I was thinking about that when you just said you wanted to get those two together. Did they kind of fight your editor or fight you with the abstinence thing?
Actually, it's because I'm a romantic, number one. I wanted, you know, everybody to walk off into the sunset. But when I was working with this particular editor, he said, not everybody gets to walk off into the sunset
right.
on their first book. So I held off, and it was hard for me to do because, you know, I wanted everything to just be fine at the end.
Susan McDuffie, what was your experience of that? Did the characters take on lives of their own?
Actually, they did. You know, I have, when I started with the book, I had a general idea of where it was going, and I had an idea of where, there's a little romance in mine as well. Murtaugh, and then there's a woman named Mariota, who is the daughter of a healer and a healer herself, and they work together in the first mystery. And so in this book, I kind of had an idea of where their relationship was going. And then as soon as Mariota showed up in the book, she kind of came down with PTSD. She had some adventures at the end of the last book, and she was reacting to those. And so she decided to go off to a nunnery because she was kind of traumatized and she thought a nunnery would be safe. So, they took off in different directions than I had originally planned.
Do you have another book coming in the series?
I do. I've got the rough draft done and I'm working on revising it. And then I have ideas for a fourth one also.
Now, what will the two of you be talking about at Collected Works this Friday?
I think just the process of writing, how our the differences and the similarities between the two books, how our, it's interesting. My book is all written in the first person, and Marie's book has several different points of view, and that's an interesting thing we might explore, and other questions.
Absolutely, and how our characters develop and where we get our ideas from. I kind of get my ideas from people I know, people I meet, and then I build them up. And someone asked me the murderer in the first book, where did you get the idea from that? And I says, you know what? That was based probably on one of my brother's ex-wives or somebody who did somebody dirty, and I just built them up into a murderer.
Marie Romero Cash has a new book. It's called Shadows Among the Ruins, and Susan McDuffie's new book is called The Fairy Hills. And once again, the two of them will be at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Friday, the 13th of May at 6 in the evening. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.